The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Thursday. Here's the rundown. The biggest story in the world is a change of government looms in Israel. As in the headline of the New York Times, Netanyahu rivals agree on Israeli coalition to oust him. Patrick Kingsley writes, Israel opposition parties announced on Wednesday that they had reached a coalition agreement to form a government and oust Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history and a dominant figure who has pushed his nation's politics to the right. The announcement could lead to the easing of a political impasse that has produced four elections in 2 years and left Israel without a stable government or a state budget. If Parliament ratifies the fragile agreement in a confidence vote in the coming days, it will also bring down the curtain, if only for an intermission, on the premiership of a leader who has defined contemporary Israel for more than any other. The new coalition is an unusual and awkward alliance between eight political parties from a diverse array of ideologies, from the left to the far right. While some analysts have hailed it as a reflection of the breadth and complexity of contemporary society, others say its members are too incompatible for the compact to last and consider it the embodiment of Israel's political dysfunction. The alliance would be led, until 2023, by Naftali Bennett, a former settler leader and standard-bearer for the religious nationalists, who opposes a Palestinian state and wants Israel to annex the majority of the occupied West Bank. He is a former ally of Mr. Netanyahu, often described as more right-wing than the prime minister. If the government lasts a whole term, it would then be led between 2023 and 2025 by Yair Lapid, a centrist former television host considered a standard-bearer for secular Israelis. It was Lapid who was picked by the president, Reuven Rivlin, 4 weeks ago to try and form a new government. It was Mr. Lapid who called Mr. Rivlin at 11:22 p.m. on Wednesday night, with just 38 minutes left before his mandate expired, to inform him that he had assembled a fragile coalition. The Washington Post headline, Israel opposition lawmakers say they're ready for parliamentary vote to replace Netanyahu. The Wall Street Journal, Netanyahu rivals agree to form new government to oust Israeli leader. In the Financial Times, Israel opposition leaders agree to oust Netanyahu. And this is the key story from the Times of Israel. Planned Lapid-Bennett security cabinet would have right-wing majority. Under a planned unity government being put together by Yesh Atid leader, that's a party, Yair Lapid, and Yamina chief Naftali Bennett, another party, in a bid to oust Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the top-level security cabinet, who have a clear majority of right-wing members, Hebrew media reported Sunday. The reported makeup of the body would indicate the extent of the concessions made by Lapid to Bennett and comes with Netanyahu trying to portray the emerging coalition as a left-wing government. But according to the Khan public broadcaster and Channel 12 News, the high-level body will be made up of either 10 or 12 members, but in either case with a clear right-wing majority. According to the reports, the security cabinet will have three Yamina members, Bennett, Ayelet Shaked, and Matan Kahana. There will be two members from the Likud breakaway New Hope Party, Gideon Saar and Zeav Elkin, along with another hardliner, Yisrael Betanyu's Avior Lieberman. Atid will have only one security cabinet member, Lapid. There will also be one representative from Blue and White, Benny Gantz, not really a dub, one representative from Labor, Merav Mikhali, and one from Meretz, Nitzan Horowitz. So it's going to be a 6-4 or 7-5 majority on the issues of most concern to most Americans, which are the security issues in the Middle East. It is the only democracy in the Middle East. It is our closest ally there, followed closely by the United Arab Emirates, little Sparta, and Egypt. But it is our closest ally. It is a nuclear power, and it faces down, it's the front line of defense against Iran and its proxy Hezbollah and terror throughout the region. So the key thing for Americans is not who's running the Ministry of Transportation in Israel, who's in charge of the desalinization, who's dealing with cultural affairs. It is noteworthy that an Arab party will be part of the coalition, again, evidence of Israel's healthy and vibrant democracy. But with Netanyahu leaving the scene after many years, it's sort of like Merkel leaving the scene after 10 years. Who comes next? Well, Naftali Bennett. The Times has a profile of him. The morning after Donald Trump's victory in the 2016 presidential election, Naftali Bennett, the energetic leader of a relatively small Israeli pro-settlement party, exulted before an audience of foreign reporters in Jerusalem. The era of a Palestinian state is over. Now Mr. Bennett, who is 49, a former high-tech entrepreneur who insists there must never be a full-fledged Palestinian state and that Israel should annex most of the occupied West Bank, is poised to become Israel's next prime minister, replacing Benjamin Netanyahu. Mr. Bennett, a former ally of Mr. Netanyahu, often described as more right-wing than the prime minister, is the independently wealthy son of American immigrants. He first entered the Israeli parliament 8 years ago and is relatively unknown and inexperienced on the international stage, leaving much of the world, not to mention many Israelis, wondering what kind of a leader he might be. Shifting between seemingly contradictory alliances, has he been called a right-wing extremist, a pragmatist, and an opportunist? But in a measure of his talents, he has now pulled off a feat that is extraordinary, even by the perplexing standards of Israeli politics. He has maneuvered himself into the top office, even though his party, Yamina, won just 7 of the 120 seats in the parliament. A canny and ambitious beneficiary of Israel's prolonged political morass, Mr. Bennett leveraged his modest but pivotal electoral weight after the inconclusive March elect in Israel's 4th in 2 years. He entered coalition talks as a kingmaker and emerged as the one wearing the crown. In a career full of paradoxes, Mr. Bennett, once a top aide to Mr. Netanyahu's 71, played a crucial role in toppling his former boss, Israel's longest-serving leader. As a result, Mr. Netanyahu was brought down, for now at least, not only by his longtime rivals on the center and the left of the political spectrum, but by someone considered even more hardline. Mr. Bennett has long championed West Bank settlers, once led the council representing them. But he has never been a settler himself and lives in Ra'anana, an affluent town in central Israel, with his wife and 4 children. He's religiously observant. He would be the first prime minister to wear a kippah, but he will head a governing coalition that is largely secular. He is best known for his views on settlements, annexation, and Palestinian statehood that many on Israel's left and center, not to mention much of the world, consider not just wrong, but dangerous. Again, where does the world get off? It's Israel's policy, not the world's policy. Yet his coalition spans Israel's fractious political spectrum from left to right and relies on the support of a small Arab Islamist party. There is also a story in the Telegraph this morning why Naftali Bennett's coalition of Israeli right-wingers and Arabs could swiftly fall apart. It's a photo-op coalition, they say. Well, whatever it is, it's change. And it looks like it's going to be sworn in. They're going to move quickly to get 61 votes to throw out the Speaker of the Knesset. And then it will all unfold in 10 days, and Benjamin Netanyahu will go into opposition. And when a new election comes, there will be a fundamental realignment of Israeli politics to the right. This is the last gasp of the left. And I say that because 65 members of the parliament are clearly right-wing, but the political division surrounding the personality of Benjamin Netanyahu have frozen American politics, Israeli politics. So when the next election occurs, and I don't think this government will go 4 years. It's got 5 years. It's got too many inherent flaws. The party will reassemble. I don't know that Netanyahu doesn't retire. He's got his corruption trials. I don't know where they stand. Neither do I know anything about Israeli law, nor do they stay at a Holiday Inn in Israel, nor do I just, nobody knows. But when it's over, there will be probably a primary challenge to him within the Likud, the largest party in Israel, which he has led for many, many years. So we will watch and see. Other headlines of the morning. Justice Department secretly obtained New York Times reporter phone records during the Trump administration. By the way, the Justice Department did the same thing on reporters' records during the Obama administration. New York City subway operator Martha's Vineyard Ferry reports cyber attacks. There is a third seat on the Exxon board going to an activist. That company, you couldn't get me to buy stock in that right now. Who knows what's going to happen? The Washington Post headlines that Trump has grown increasingly consumed with ballot audits as he pushes falsehoods that election was stolen is based primarily on third-hand reports, reports of people who talk to him, hearsay sort of stuff. And the Army Corps of Engineers, tasked with making Miami safe from storm surges, came up with a 20-foot seawall that will destroy 6 miles of the city's real estate. That's what happens when you ask the government to come up with a solution. Finally, in Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega has, well, this is a flash from the past, arrested his leading opponent. That's the headlines of the morning. That's the rundown. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined by the Dean of American Journalism, Dan Bowles. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
I'm well, Hugh. How are you?
I'm exhausted. I just did an hour-long interview with a vaccine skeptic, Dr. Peter McCullough, and it's one of those interviews where, you know, I try not to ever leave, as you do. You're kind of a model for me. Don't leave your neutral ground, but sometimes you get pulled off of your neutral ground because the people you're talking to aren't responsive to the questions. It's very frustrating when that happens, Dan. I'm sure you've encountered it, 10,000 times?
Well, more than a handful, certainly, yes.
Yeah, so forgive me. I am prepared, but I just got to find your article on the GOP. Would you put forward your thesis that the GOP is following a false trail? I have some arguments with it, but I can't pull it up right now because I'm so disoriented by that interview. It's really unusual for me, but go ahead. State the premise.
Here's the premise. Donald Trump has planted the seeds of a false story, a lie about what happened in the 2020 election, which is that it was stolen or terribly corrupted, widespread irregularities, etc. That has taken root with millions of his supporters and followers. Republican politicians are responding to that, in part because they feel a need to respond to their base by introducing bills around the country that would restrict voting and that would, in many cases, make it potentially easier to effectively challenge elections before certification in 2024, and that one follows from the other, and that's a threat to the way we've conducted our elections in the past, and to what I describe as one of the pillars of democracy, which is a fair and open and an election system that's run in a nonpartisan way, or certainly a bipartisan way, not one that has great overtones of partisanship.
Now, Dan, for the benefit of the audience and for you, because I'm sure you're not hanging on my every word here, I don't believe there was any significant fraud in any of the four states contested. I don't believe any evidence of any fraud was ever introduced that was persuasive. There was not one single ruling in favor of the argument of fraud, and I do not believe the election was stolen in any way. And I've said that from the day after the election forward, and I've told the president person to person. There are other people in the room, but there were only four people in the room. I told him he lost the election because of bad polling and bad strategy, not because of fraud. And so it's my point of view is well known, and my audience can disagree or agree with it. But I like to quote Hillary Clinton. You can hold two thoughts. She told me that on the show. You can hold two thoughts. So that's thought number one. Thought number two. There were massive changes in the law, which I do not like and which I believe undermine voter integrity. And I believe we need voter ID in every election, in every precinct in the United States. You should show an ID. I do not like ballot drop boxes. I hate them. I do not believe in having private sponsorship of them, as it is alleged that Mark Zuckerberg sponsored. And I haven't talked to Mark about it, though I have talked with Mark a couple of times. I don't know if he sponsored that or not. But I understand all the problems and the innovations and the COVID-driven changes, for example, in Pennsylvania and in Georgia under the consent decree. And I'm aware of all those problems. So my two thoughts are, no, the election wasn't stolen. Joe Biden was elected president fairly handily, about 46,000 votes over four states, not one of which is subject to to overturning. And number two, it was a shambles and a mess, a series of improvisations, and the states that are changing voter integrity laws may be responding to their base, but I hope every state in the union does it everywhere because I believe in voter ID. Are those two thoughts, in your view, compatible?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's compatible, but the question is, what is the real motivation for people on who are pushing these laws? And certainly there were improvisations because of COVID. I think we all understand that. But what is the evidence that those improvisations led to some some sort of faulty election or you know, bad counting or illegalities? I mean, that one does not necessarily flow from the other. One of the points I made in the piece is that not every provision of every law that that's being considered in legislatures is bad. Nor is it the case that all blue states have, you know, perfect systems and all red states are going backwards and doing terrible things. There are some blue states that have, you know, more restrictive laws in terms of early voting and absentee voting than some red states, and that some of the provisions are in existence. And the state of New York has never had very expansive voting laws, and they could take a look at theirs. But it does not seem to me that the reaction to this has a lot more to do than the fact that people believe that they lost the election because of those changes. And I don't know that there is any empirical evidence that that's the case.
Now, Dan, let me comment. I went down to the Republican Governors Conference. I went to the National Republican Senatorial Committee gathering. I've talked to a score of governors and senators over the last 2 weeks. None of them believe that the election was stolen. None of them. No one believes it. Zero. They do believe, however, that voting has to be cleaned up significantly for, and I'll just give you one bit. Anecdotal evidence is evidence of anecdotes. You know that. But here's my anecdotal evidence. I continue to receive ballots in California 6 years after I left, 5 years after I left, as does my wife and as do my son, because we're on the roll and they send us a ballot every primary and every general election, because that's what they do in California. They do it all over the state. I think that's a nightmare on the margin. And when you have Iowa congressional districts decided by 4 votes or 6 votes and New York congressional districts decided by a dozen, we can't allow that. And we can't allow the idea of shotgunning ballots everywhere in the United States, nor can we allow machines to do voter verification signatures for which there is a degree of malleability. In other words, I think our system, as John Fund has all argued for decades, has been, you know, I mean, you get down to the microscopic level, you end up with Florida 2000. And this predates the 2020 election. And it's got to be fixed, but it's got to be fixed in a way. I like the Israeli system, you know, back, like, basically go home and vote. And if you're not there, you don't get to vote. And you better be in the hospital with a doctor's picture next to you in order to get an absentee. That's the Hugh Hewitt system, because I believe we've got to have integrity in the system. But I don't think they're related, Dan, because what the Republicans are arguing about is the worry of future election fraud as the fraudsters get better. And as you know, the history of the Democratic Party is a history of voter fraud, whether it was Tammany or Daley or Pendergast. It's in the DNA of the Democratic Party. Not all of it, but it's there. And there are books written about it. I wrote one of them. You have the floor. I mean, I just sometimes think we conflate too many issues and they all get jumbled together when they shouldn't be jumbled together.
Well, we're long past the Tammany era, and I mentioned New York as a case in which it has essentially ancient or, you know, archaic voting
yes,
laws. That,
yes.
And I agree that voter rolls need to be made, you know, as up to date as possible. I mean, I'm not arguing that there are no reforms that could be done in the name of, you know, making elections more effective, more efficient, and in which people have confidence in them. But what I'm seeing is something that goes beyond that. That some of these things certainly do appear aimed at making it more difficult for Democratic voters to turn out. And that, to me, and again, as I said, the the massive effort that's underway, and I use that word slightly with hyperbole, but I mean there have been hundreds of bills introduced in legislatures this year around the country, and in three quarters of the states probably, to change the laws, and that certainly is a reaction to 2020, with a sense that something was unfair about 2020 at a time when it's not necessarily been proven that it was unfair. So,
well, I think that the
political instinct of people who are sponsoring these goes well beyond what you're talking about, which is to try to create a fair system. I mean, after 2000, we had a national commission, and we had efforts to clean things up, and to some extent it helped. But this is a constant, it's a constant process and constant issue that has to be dealt with. But I think it has to be dealt with in good faith, and in a more bipartisan way.
We're out of time. I think it is being dealt with in good faith. The roller coaster of innovation was bad for election integrity, but I would reject wholly the idea that there is an attempt to introduce suppression of the vote. Indeed, it would be unconstitutionally illegal to do so. And if it was based on race or gender, it would be thrown out immediately. But, Dan, I will now go read the article, and I'll catch up with you, America. 1-800-520-1234. Follow Dan Balz at Dan Balz on Twitter. Follow me to the next segment of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Lawyers, guns, and money, America.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.
That's what you get at the Hugh Hewitt Show. Another great lawyer, Jim Talen, is here, former senator from Missouri, my friend with the Bipartisan Policy Center. Follow him on Twitter at Jim Talen. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. It's nice you call me a great lawyer, but I used to have a line I'd use on the stump around Missouri where they were kind of suspicious of lawyers, and I would be introduced as a lawyer and somebody from St. Louis, and they didn't really like that either. And so I would always say, look, if it helps any, I'm not a very good lawyer. And that always got a great laugh. So,
well, I just had an hour-long conversation with Dr. Peter McCullough from Texas, who's a big vaccine skeptic. And, I can't not be a lawyer. And so when someone's non-responsive to a question and I ask it three or four times, I have to tell them the credibility gets injured, right, Jim?
Well, I watched some of that, you, and it really was classic. He just did not want to give a direct answer to several of your questions. And I was wondering when you were going to let go. I could tell you were having a little bit of fun with it. He said some interesting things, and it's such a great thing that, and I really mean this, you were kind to say I was a great lawyer. You're a great interviewer, and you show that you can be open to different points of view, and you can respect people and like people and still vigorously disagree with people. I introduced one time a nominee for the leadership. They asked me to do it in front of the Republican conference, and we just had this very contentious debate, and I stood up, and I said, I looked around, and I looked at these 200 people, and I said, I actually like almost everybody here. I got a good laugh. I mean, I do. I like most of the people I've met in politics on both sides of the aisle.
And, now, Senator, this brings me to the biggest problem in America. I really do believe this is the biggest problem in America, is the refusal to attribute good faith to opponents in a conversation, a party, or any kind of dispute. And Jake Tapper, with whom I have disputes, came up, I call it the Tapper rule, which is I will indulge the presumption of good faith in everyone until proven otherwise. And so when I had Dr. Collins on yesterday and we disagree, I know he's operating in good faith. I know the man. And when I have on Dr. McCullough, I know he's operating in good faith. I just, when I disagree with people, it doesn't mean they're rotten. It means I think they're wrong. And we've lost sight of that in America, I think, generally.
You are completely correct. Now, we are enjoined to take that attitude by our common religion, right?
Yes,
and that
absolutely
doesn't mean we have to be, of course, we should not be blind to evidence of bad faith. And if it's a presumption, it's not irrebuttable. And if there's sufficient evidence produced and it's relevant, then yes, we have to conclude that people are operating for hidden or invidious motives. But that should never be the assumption behind it. And I completely agree. And I've tried to do that in my career. I don't think I've ever suffered for that. I'm giving people the benefit of the doubt until I couldn't. I mean, I was 9-2 in 11 elections that I ran. I lost two of them, but I don't think I lost any of them, either of them, for that reason.
I agree. I think that people can have differences, and Missouri might want to go one way or another way at any particular time, and it's redder now than when you ran, and so people would change their minds. But this attribution of bad faith is, it's a drum I bang. I think it's the media's fault, because I believe that conflict sells soap, and so the manufacturing of conflict and with it ferocity of temper is what drives so much of the media cycle.
Well, I think that, but also the fact that on the internet now, we communicate anonymously. Even if you give your name, you're not looking at the person, number one. And then number two, you're communicating in short bursts where the temptation to be snarky or to categorize somebody in a negative way is very, very high. So it, to some extent, it's also the medium. But I would agree with you. And, you know, you've talked about this a lot, and you're correct. When reporters or journalists or pundits or whoever's doing it, when they do not understand issues and they take a very simplistic view of it, then they tend to believe that anybody who disagrees with them has to be really bad, because otherwise they would see the great truth that, you know, that they see. And I had I've hijacked your interview, but I remember a guy who took me under his wing in the legislature when I was still in my 20s. We were having a very contentious debate, and I was listening, and he walked up behind me and he said, "You know, Jim, there really are two sides to almost everything."
Huh? Oh, you know, that's true. This anticipates a conversation I'll have next week with David Bossie, who's in charge of setting up the debate rules for 2024.
Right.
I believe that the Republican National Committee has to exile mainstream media from the primary debates. I would let Jim Talent ask questions and Robert O'Brien and Hugh Hewitt and Mary Catherine Hamm. I would go out there and find as diverse and broad a way of center-right people to ask questions, because I do not believe our party should be hijacked by people who believe that they are wrong and rotten at the same time. What do you think about that?
This is something I remember talking with Romney's people in 2012. We have to get out of this mode of doing these debates, and not only because questions are asked which are, you know, unfair or focusing on very minor issues, but because of the big issues that are not brought up unless somebody like you is on the panel. And you mentioned this the other day to the chairman. Like, what about, for example, the national defense, which, you know, or the Navy as a which is hugely important. Our friend Jerry Hendricks has written so extensively about this. What about the issue of whether we should reorient our philosophy, foreign policy and defense philosophy in towards a maritime direction? That's a presidential level decision. Now, how you do it is not, you know, whether you build frigates or whether you build unmanned or whatever, that's not a presidential level decision. But that the basic question of whether whether we have retreated too much from being a maritime power is, and those questions need to be asked.
And I think they're above the pay grade of a lot of them. One of them would be the other night, the Nixon seminar. Former Secretary of State Pompeo and Robert O'Brien were discussing with the under 50-year-old members of the seminar whether or not there were means to drive a wedge between Russia and China in great power competition. That's high-level stuff, and it's important. And do you think we'll ever get a great power competition question from anyone in the media about whether or not it is in the United States national interest to attempt to drive a wedge between Russia and China?
And the fact that we haven't had that question, at least I don't recall it. Now, you...
Never.
You what? No. Yeah, I don't think so. It's a confession of the bankruptcy of the debate system, because, as you know, I mean, the president is the primary architect of American foreign and national security policy. The Constitution confides this in that office. It is inevitable, and it's probably the most important thing they do. When you get in areas like domestic policy, like as we're seeing now, like the infrastructure bill, whether you like it or not, that's basically going to be congressionally driven if we pass one at all. Okay, but foreign policy is different, and we don't get good questions about these kinds of subjects. And since they know that's not going to be asked, they don't study up. You know, in other words, they don't really think deeply about them, the candidates, which means the one who wins hasn't necessarily done the kind of work that he or she should have done. No, you pushed a button of mine. You're absolutely correct about it.
Well, then, last question, Jim. The Presidential Debate Commission is just a completely dysfunctional organization now. And I think Ronna McDaniel sent a letter to them the day after our conversation detailing that. Could that be salvaged with new membership, or do we just have to go back to what it was, which is the campaigns negotiate with each other, and if they can't come to an agreement, there's no debates?
Yeah, I think it's the latter, because we don't have control over putting new members on. Maybe it could be done, but to try and reform an organization from the outside is a very, very difficult view. I mean, and I just, again, I've been through this, not as a candidate, but as somebody who was, you know, a senior advisor, really, to a candidate. And I conclude, because a lot of good people have tried to do that and have failed. So I'm starting to think that we need to plow around it, as Lincoln said. You know, if the log is too big to pull out.
Plow around it. Yep.
You plow around it. And I think that's what we're going to have to do.
Great comment. Jim Talent, always a pleasure talking to you. Follow him at Jim Talent on Twitter. The Bipartisan Policy Center is lucky to have him. I got to tell you about relieffactor.com. It's the third hour of the show. It's the third time I've told you. If you're going to get out there and walk, run, swim, bicycle, if you're Dwayne and you're running around the studio with your heads between your hands screaming at me, he's going to pull something. He's going to actually throw his back out. He's so mad at me this morning. And Adam is patiently mad at me because I blew through every break with Dr. McCullough. And you really got to go hear the whole interview at the interview with Hugh Hewitt. Harley's mad at me because I'm making him do two podcasts, Dr. Collins from yesterday and then Dr. McCullough from today. So people understand. I just sit here asking my questions. That's my job. But I do take relieffactor.com every day, and they sponsor this platform because you want to hear whatever it is I'm talking about.